Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, the Retina Podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 116, I am joined by Dr. Daniel Chow of the University of California, San Diego, and Dr. Anjay Kurian of the University of Rochester to discuss residency and fellowship-related issues in a journal club focusing on three recent articles in JAMA Ophthalmology. As our separate shameless plug, anyone who's attending the upcoming American Society of Retinal Specialists annual meeting in Vancouver, if you enjoy this program, please try and attend our first ever social media and online content for ophthalmologists and structural course. Dr. Sunir Gar, Charles Wyckoff, David Almeida, Anjay Kurian and I will be doing a 75-minute course on Friday, July 20th, starting at 1 p.m. For more details, you can always feel free to contact me directly. It should be informational, but approachable, relaxed, and we hope to continue this tradition in years coming. So if you have time, please try and swing by. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be rejoined by two of our previous correspondents. First, in alphabetical order, from the University of California, San Diego, Dr. Daniel Chow. Dan, welcome back.
Happy to be here as always, Jay.
And from the University of Rochester, Dr. Anjay Kurian. Anjay, welcome.
Thanks for having me back, Jay.
So we're going to do something a little different with our Journal Club episode today. So we typically focus on very scientific, medical, or surgical retina articles. The theme of today is we're going to discuss three articles regarding residency, fellow training, or related to the residency or fellowship application process. And then we have a fourth bonus article, which is just for kicks for me, and we'll get to that at the end. All of these articles from JAMA Ophthalmology, I would love to say we're sponsored by JAMA Ophthalmology, and we're all wearing JAMA Ophthalmology hats and t-shirts right now, but we aren't. It just worked out that way. But that's an open invitation I don't even know who publishes JAMA. Is JAMA its own thing? JAMA is its own thing. I don't know. It's Elsevier or LWW. Anyway, on topic. So the first article we're going to discuss is called was titled Association of Mentor to Program Contact and Applicant Rank Disclosure with Vitreoretinal Fellowship Applicants Final Mouch Outcome in 2016-2017. This was published online April 26, 2018. Authors were Steve Christensen, James Osher, and Chris Riemann, all from the University of Cincinnati. Dan, you want to start us off and tell us a little bit about what they sought to do in this study and what they showed?
Yeah, so this was a very interesting study, essentially looking at characteristics of the vitreoretinal surgery batch. What they did was they surveyed almost all of the fellowship applicants from 2016 and 2017 through an online survey, and essentially got a lot of demographic information, men versus women, how many programs did they apply to, how many programs did they rank, how many of them matched at their first, second, or third choice, as well as the cost for interview, and they also included some questions related to if their mentor had contacted the program, as well as if the applicant self-disclosed if they were their number one choice or not. And I have to say the authors need to be commended for having a very high response rate. So out of about 200 people, about 100 people applied per year, they had a 77% response rate, which if you look at the methods, I think is related to multiple reminder emails, as well as a financial incentive as well. So I think that really speaks to the quality of the data. And of interest, most applicants applied to around 33 programs. They ranked about 11 programs, and their average rank was at their number third match program. 43% matched at their first choice, 23% at their second choice, and 14% at their third choice. Additionally, interesting enough, the average cost of interviewing was about $5,500, and 74% of them had their mentor contact the program on their behalf, and I think about the same number also let the program know if they were their first choice or not.
So, Anjay, there's a couple of discussion points we can take, and we can start. They broke it down very nicely in the discussion of the article, each topic. So let's start in terms of costs. And this is something that's been brought up before. So the average amount spent was $5,500 with a range of $500 to $13,500. And God bless whoever spent only $500 on their application, because I don't even know how that's possible. Because I feel like the base expenditure for the SF match is almost that much. But, you know, they said this is not necessarily atypical. There was another study out of orthopedic surgery where the mean was about $4,670. And you needed about 10 days off to do your interviews. You know, this is an interesting topic, is reform. And, right, are these costs, are there ways to control these costs or ways that that people can figure out to make this a less expensive? And also, from if you're in residency, it can be difficult to miss all those days.
Yeah, you know, certainly people have talked about limiting the number of applications and things like that to try to rein in some of these costs so that people are more selective in where they're applying and where they attend for interviews. But there's certainly pros and cons to anything like that as well.
Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would say, you know, in terms of limiting the costs, like one practical way you do that, you could eliminate the travel, have maybe some of these online video conference interviews. But I think there's something to be said of being able to physically visit programs in their environment and interact with the faculty there. I think it gives you a much better sense and much more information than you might get online or through talking with colleagues. So even though it is expensive, I think hopefully it being a one-time cost that it is. I think the amount of information that you get, not only about ranking programs, but also in terms of developing relationships with future colleagues in your field, I think is definitely worth the cost.
Yeah, I would agree. I think getting a sense of the atmosphere is important and the type of people, and that works both ways. I think it can be really difficult on paper or even on video to get a sense of what a person's like until you meet them in person. And then there's arguments about how important that is, and I think that would vary program to program in terms of what they're valuing in their prospective fellows. But regardless of where you do your fellowship, you're going to spend a significant amount of time with your surgical or medical retina mentors. If you're going to spend a significant amount of time with somebody, I think it's important to get a sense of, you know, whether that's there's a chemistry there that you guys can get along and can make it a more fruitful relationship. I think you know, the other thing we're going to talk about before we get into the main issue, which is the self-selection process. You know, we can't ignore there's a gender disparity here, right? So they mentioned that it's about a quarter of the applicants were women, and that's more than the survey from the AAO, where it was 14% of AAO members of retina subspecialists in the U.S. were women in 2014. So there's more women, and there was an increase from 2016 to 2017. But there's still kind of this gap, and hopefully that will continue to decrease. And, you know, as they mentioned, there are more women going to medical school than men at this point. So throughout all fields of medicine, hopefully within ophthalmology and VR surgery, that will decrease as well.
Yeah, Jay, I definitely think that's true. And I think with the emergence of, you know, more women in the retina field and being on the podium and being able to serve as mentors for younger female retina specialists, I think that's been a very positive trend. And, you know, there are organizations like WINR, the Women in Retina, and it seems like maybe compared to other fields in which there's such a gender disparity, I feel at least that there's a fairly robust kind of grassroots women mentoring program in retina. So I'd imagine that those numbers will continue to.
And the other thing, so this is the part that's most interesting, I think, and we all kind of implicitly understood this when we applied for fellowship. We were told this was this self-selection element, right? So if you look at this, if you're someone who's thinking about applying for fellowship, you might look at this and be like, wow, like the odds are in my favor. There is a 43% chance I'm going to rank at my number one. And there's a, what is it? It's 70, I'm just doing the math. My 72% chance I'm going to match somewhere in my top three, which sounds excellent. But there is a self-selection element to this, which the match was not designed for. It was always designed for independent rankings by the programs and the applicants and then the algorithm to kind of generate. But I think we all implicitly understand anecdotally, and this is more collected anecdotal evidence via the survey, but that there is an importance of people tend to rank programs higher where they think they have a better chance of matching, and programs ranking applicants higher if they think the applicants are likely to come. And we can go into the merits or pros and cons of whether that's the way it should be, but this kind of emphasizes that that's the way it's been constructed. And that's probably more true at the fellowship level than at the residency level. Ajay, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I agree. It definitely shows some evidence that that's possible. We don't have the full data set from what the program directors are also thinking. And so I think that without that, we can't make that full conclusion. It could just be that, you know, especially in a small field like retina, where a lot of mentors happen to know a lot of these program directors personally and things like that, they might be recommending this place as number one because they truly feel like it's a good fit for that applicant. And through that personal relationship, the program director might be more trusting of that recommendation since it is such a small field. And so it's a little hard to know if the disclosure is what makes it more likely that you're going to match number one, or whether you're coming to that decision with a concerted effort from your mentorship's guidance and stuff like that.
Right. Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with Adi. I think there's definitely an element of self-selection there, and I think it's, again, hard to figure. I think, you know, there's definitely, at least from my experience, there's not kind of like an implicit, you know, handshake that occurs that a lot of programs are pre-selecting number one or predetermining their match. But I definitely agree that there is a kind of alignment in terms of matching.
And I think the other thing, and we're gonna get into the extracurriculars at the end, but this is true of many real life scenarios. I'm gonna alienate our listeners who don't care, but like NBA season's over, NBA free agency. You know, there's not supposed to be conversations between teams and players until a fixed date on July 1st. It's actually not allowed, similar to like programs asking an applicant or contacting an applicant after the interview to try to get a sense of where they rank. That's not allowed under the match rules. But there's no rule saying that players can't talk to each other. And we saw that last year with like James Harden and Chris Paul kind of talking to figure it out so they could both end up in Houston, and or in 2010 with the Heat with Bosch and Wade and LeBron. And similarly, there's no rules saying that the applicant can't reach out and disclose their intentions and that may influence. And like Ajay said, we don't have the full story because we don't know the program director's side. All we get here is the applicant side. But it's interesting. And then this probability of disclosing your number one rank, it also, even though it shouldn't technically affect your rank position, it does make a little bit of implicit sense, as you both mentioned. Any further thoughts on this paper before we move on, Ajay?
Yeah, I think their response rate was just amazing. For survey data, this is definitely very, very strong survey data. And I don't know if this is necessarily applicable to every other field or residency as a whole, just because I think retina is a pretty small world, and that definitely plays a role. I think I was just thinking about it after reading this, but Yasha, who was one of our co-residents, resident at the time when he wasn't attending, is now my fellow, and one of my residents when at Rochester is now Dan's fellow. And so
you incestuous beast.
it's a very small world, and I think it's very easy to trust somebody's recommendation when you know them, and that does make a big difference. And so that might be certainly a big confounding factor in all this.
Yeah,
I think that definitely plays a role in terms of, I think, as people do their due diligence in terms of, you know, is someone really as good as they seem on paper? And I think that's definitely something that we try to corroborate. I would say that in and of itself is usually not the deciding factor that we would rank someone very highly. Usually they're already very outstanding in their own right, and then maybe it'll be shifting between a couple of those positions. Let's see. Oh yeah, this person really, you know, he really was a superstar in residency, and has a very strong like recommendation from Ajay. And so I think it plays a role, but it's not the, I think still the applicant still has to be very stellar in and of its own regard.
Yes, definitely.
You know, the final thing you mentioned, the response rate, Ajay. It just, I mean, the only carrot they offered was a $50 Amazon gift card to one person out of everyone who responded. Oh, maybe that was the difference maker. Maybe we just, I mean, that's incredible. That's like the odds of you getting that, and then the yield per person is so low, but maybe that's enough to get people to fill out a survey. I have a couple surveys that have been circulating. Maybe I need to attach a gift card. That's a really good idea.
I think also it might speak to the kind of the community of like vitreoretinal applicants. I think we all know when we're applying for applicants, you know, there's about 100 or so applicants, and as you go through, you probably meet most of them. So I'm assuming there was probably also a pretty strong grassroots effort that this was felt that this was important data to get out there for the community, and I think that also contributed to the high response rate. And the ability to personally shame people by name if they're not responding.
Well,
that's the slide print at the end of the email after the $50 gift card.
Well, we're going to take this. Unfortunately, these articles are going to get a little more sobering, not more uplifting as we go. And the next one is entitled Rate of Unverifiable Publications Among Ophthalmology Residency Applicants Invited to Interview from April 19, 2018 by Temez Tauscher Brown et al. Dan, you did the last one. Ajay, you want to quickly just take us through this article and then we can kind of discuss the implications?
Sure. So this is an assessment done at Vanderbilt looking at residency applications for the entering class from 2012 to 2017. And so they looked at 322 applications, and they essentially did different searches, PubMed, Google Scholar, to try to identify if the publication that was listed, including the authorship order and things like that, on these applicants' SF Match application was actually verifiable. And they found that approximately there were 24, there were 6.8% had unverifiable applications. And so 9.2 had unverifiable application. And so it was a fairly large amount of unverifiable applications that were present. And they tried to do some other analysis based on some other demographic factors like their USMLE score and other degrees of education to see if there's any association. They didn't really find anything that was really associated with an increased risk of having this unverifiable application. They did break it down to how it was unverifiable, and so the largest amount was just they were just not able to find it. But there were smaller amounts where it was only an abstract and not a full-length publication. The authorship was incorrect, or the person was actually not listed as an author, or the journal was incorrect, or there was actually a different title.
Dan, your initial thoughts on this paper?
Yeah, I would say, you know, interesting in the introduction, I think a number of different specialties have done this type of looking at unverifiable publications, and the range is quite high, it seems like, between, you know, GI, neurosurgery, et cetera, can vary from about, you know, 10 to 45%. So I think it's important to do. I think it does seem a little bit, I guess every time I hear this kind of data, it does seem a little bit shocking that about 10% of people who interviewed at Vanderbilt in this six-year time frame who had publications had an unverifiable publication. So that means like 1 in 10 people, like if you're interviewing with a room of 30 people, 3 of them are going to have a publication that was unverifiable. And you hope it's due to some little thing like, oh, maybe the names are spelled a little bit differently, or the authors are in a different order, but a lot of them just weren't able to be found. And so I think that's definitely sobering in that I think in any kind of highly competitive process, there's always going to be there's always going to be kind of this unspoken incentive to try to, bend the rules in your favor. And so in some ways, I would say that the rate is, I guess, average or maybe below average compared to other fields, but then also it's quite high as well. And I think it's just something to keep in mind. And I think having better, trying to continue and improve the safeguards and the integrity of the application process, is important. You know, I think something like this about publications, I think there's some nice action items where they talk about including like the PMC number, and then maybe SFmatch can include something where they auto-verify these things. And you hate to just eliminate these applications just because of some typo or something like that. But I think it is, you know, nice information to have. And these are also people who were selected to interview. So, you know, of the large, you know, application pool, these are like these are the 50 or 60 best applications out of probably a pool of 450. So it's not like these are just people who have no chance of getting into ophthalmology who are putting these on. These are very competitive applicants. Most of them, probably all of them, ended up matching somewhere. And so I think better understanding this is important moving forward.
So I think that, you know, there's been prior study. They referenced this Wiggins study from 2000 to 2004. And the most interesting difference I found between this study and that study, and they mentioned this, was in that study, which was the early 2000s, only less than a quarter of applicants reported a publication. And now, three quarters of applicants have published. And I think that reflects the increasing standards, maybe not just for ophthalmology, but for other fields, and almost going to this quote-unquote arms race, where applicants feel this pressure that you're talking about to demonstrate that they're academically involved. And we have all mentored medical students, and there's this understanding you need to have more to flesh out. We always talk about fleshing out your application. Now, we ever know, we want to flesh out dishonestly, right? But it's about doing good work and reflecting that to reflect your commitment, because more and more people are showing this. It's almost an expectation you have some component of research on your application. In terms of solutions, I'll postulate a couple things, right? So, I mean, one of the solutions to this, besides, obviously, you want people to be ethical and be honest, but if the SF match could, if it's electronic eventually and it requires you to electronically enter your peer-reviewed publication so it can pull the reference, that would be very helpful. And then you could have a separate section for other publications. That way, because when you're reviewing these applications, obviously it'd be really helpful at every program to have someone to verify, but usually you want to assume honesty. And it would take a lot of legwork to have someone look through every single application in someone's CV to try to figure out if they're honest or not, or if they're real, or if they're in PubMed. And if that could be kind of automated, that would make this whole process a little seamless on the other side. I'm thinking just from the side of reviewing these applications. Ajay, thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great idea. I think that would definitely help overcome some of these obstacles. I think it'll be helpful to have an option to enter in other like stages of publications, like in press and things like that. But yeah, you know, until I read this paper, I never knew that this was even a problem. It certainly opened up my eyes to this being an issue. Yeah, I would just never imagine, yeah, somebody taking that chance.
Right. It's like one is you hope that people aren't dishonest. The second is you hope that people would, the fear of being caught would prevent people from trying to do this. But again, I think also one of the issues is maybe the SF match needs to be very specific about the instructions, right? And they mentioned this, right? That it's just called research activities, papers, and or additional information. That's a very vague kind of heading. And maybe if it was like, you know, your research activities in one section, and then it was specifically saying your peer-reviewed publications that are already published and your ongoing activities. So you can kind of separate those out, and it's much easier to kind of look at something and be like, okay, like this is what this person has done and this is what this person is doing. This is stuff that person has worked with that maybe does not result in publication, but maybe is still academically important.
You know what? One other thing I was just thinking about was that, you know, with the explosion of these open access journals, you know, a lot of them are probably not either in PubMed or in Google Scholar
at this time.
What percentage of these are actual, you know, publications in these journals, but if they're difficult to verify through the standard search engine.
Well, some great examples that, for example, Retina Cases and Brief Reports for years was not indexed on PubMed. And now it is, and any previous publication is now indexed on PubMed. But if you applied 5 years ago and listed that as a peer-reviewed publication, then it wouldn't show up in those indexes. I think, you know, they talked about using Google Scholar. And you would think, though, if you redid this study and just did a search, if you just searched the title that was listed as well as the name of the applicant as an author on Google, even in Google or any search engine, you could verify whether or not it was available somewhere and what kind of publication it was. They didn't do that, it looks like, based on their methodology, but you could do that to capture those types of publications.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure that they did some degree of extensive searching on like things like Google Scholar, because they were able to break down the significant title discrepancy, the incorrect journal, incorrect author, and things like that. And so I think they must have put some effort into trying to track down these articles, or else they wouldn't have been able to categorize those other incorrect unverifiable publications.
There were only 24 of them, so I'm sure they could have searched those individually and really see if it was Google or not.
Oh, and they did. I apologize. Yeah. They did mention they did search in Google as well. They mentioned that towards the end. Yeah. Ajay, you talked about the eye-opening aspect. For me, again, I always think from our perspective, whether we're reviewing applications or most of us just mentoring people, I wonder, it's obviously the responsibility of the medical student who's applying to make sure there's no typos, they have the right journal. We're not even talking about lying. I'm just talking about errors in terms of how they list their publications. I mean, this is a little eye-opening to me. Maybe, you know, for mentees of mine, maybe this is something when, before they submit their application, you always want to review it. But when I'm looking at their academic section, to kind of go through it point by point with a comb and just make sure there's no issues or errors there. Similarly, like if we review one of our mentees' papers, we make sure the references are good, there's no plagiarism, like, you know, things that, again, we ethically understand are wrong. But I think that we do have to account for an experience level here, right? And some of the people who are applying, even though they've gone through 4 years of medical school, their academic involvement may be limited to the work they've done with one of us or anyone who's listening, one of the attendings who's out there. And it's up to us to kind of teach them good academic principles.
Yeah, I agree. You know, some of this, you know, I'd like to think that some of this is not purely intentional, and you know, maybe they honestly did not know the difference between the abstract and the complete journal publication. Maybe they just thought that they were so close to getting it published because it came back for reviews or something like that, and it was favorably reviewed initially, that they thought that it was in the bag, and they just didn't know how to categorize that. So that's certainly a possibility, and I do think that that's where the mentorship can help. But I, you know, unfortunately, I think that some of it might not be as innocent.
Dan, any final thoughts before we move forward?
No, I think we covered everything.
Well, our next article, again, getting more sobering, the final one is that before we get to our fun one, is Resident Wellness and U.S. Ophthalmic Graduate Medical Education, The Resident Perspective by Elaine Tran, Ingrid Scott, and Melissa Clark et al., published online in JAMA Ophthalmology May 3rd, 2018. Dan, you just want to take us through, this is a short kind of, again, survey data, but you just want to take us through what was assessed and what were the results?
Yeah, so this was a survey of it was sent out to all ophthalmology residents from 2017. So there were 1,048 ophthalmology residents who were listed on different websites, and the authors contacted each of them by email with a 12-question multiple-choice survey, and then they also received two reminder emails. The idea was to gauge, in terms of, you know, the wellness, if there were any episodes of burnout, depression, suicide, and how well, like, were there wellness programs in their residency, and how easy was it to access them? So of the about 1,000 residents, 23%, about, so 240 responded to the survey, and most of them, about 70%, reported that there was some issue of depression, burnout, or suicide among the residents within the last year. And then 26% said they were involved specifically, where a case where fatigue, burnout, or depression may have affected medical outcomes. And then less than half of the applicants said that there was an emphasis on wellness within the residency program. And only about a quarter of the programs had like a formal residency wellness program. And of note, when they surveyed the residents in terms of what was the main barrier to going to these wellness programs, it was a lack of time.
Ajay, your reaction again, surprised, does match what you think you would see when assessing kind of our residents.
Yeah, you know, the number seems pretty high from from my impressions, but you know, they did survey a fairly large amount of people from different programs, and so I think that's probably more accurate, and I think the people are probably more honest in their survey data than necessarily how they carry themselves from day to day. I don't know. It's not really something that I thought about or anything during my residency experience.
It's because you're so happy.
I think I'm just not introspective enough. But
that's a good point.
But I actually don't know if any of my co-residents felt that way either. But I think it's one of those things where, you know, I feel like everybody might not exhibit that feeling. I think that if people exhibited those feelings very blatantly, I think we'd be much more aware of how big a problem this is. And sometimes, you know, even though it's a relatively low response rate, sometimes survey data like this actually helps open up our eyes to how big of a problem this is.
Well, I'm going to take a step forward and say, you know, if I were answering the survey, I put myself back to when I was a resident. And it would depend on the year of residency, too. And I think that here there wasn't, you know, I think that's not as useful in a survey like this, because every program structure in terms of which year it tends to be the more work-heavy year. And for us, it was our first year. I think that there were definitely times during first year I felt burnt out, and I'm not ashamed to say it. And I think that it would be normal given the workload and kind of the learning curve and everything you're trying to deal with. Again, you may not carry yourself that way. And maybe that's a different discussion, whether, you know, socially we need to allow people to express that more. But yeah, I think it's normal. Unfortunately, and maybe we shouldn't be normal to be burnt out or, you know, have anxiety or depression when you're in that really, you know, tough year, or you're really trying to learn and there's a lot of things on your plate. And I think that the biggest thing is, again, and this is a physician problem, not just a resident problem, is, you know, sometimes we just don't take care of ourselves, and this is a balance, right? Because sometimes our jobs require us, regardless of field of medicine, to put aside our own health or wellness temporarily in the micro moments for patient issues or patient care issues. But if you compound enough micro moments, then you end up with, on the macro level, not taking care of yourself, which can be a big problem. It's similar to, again, I'm going to pull in my NBA analogy. It's similar to an NBA player that, you know, gets dinged up and is like, well, you know, I'm just going to take an injection of a painkiller and play this one game, you know, because it's the NBA finals and I need to play this game, versus they start doing that on a regular basis. And next thing you know, they're either addicted to painkillers or they ignore something and they get a serious injury and their career's over, right? Like there's, you can make short-term sacrifices to your health, your wellness, your mental well-being. But if you keep doing that, then it can add up. And every person's different in terms of their baseline levels of propensity to mental health issues, depression, anxiety. And these are things culturally in medicine, as in many other fields, we just don't talk about that much. And it's becoming something, thankfully, that's being recognized more. Dan, do the numbers surprise you? You know, I didn't really ask you your thoughts. You kind of just broke it down. Do you feel like this is consistent with what you would expect? And then I'm going to ask you guys to offer kind of, you know, are there ways to reduce this? Or is residency, you know, there's probably a balance, but, you know, the old school thing is residency is just hard. And there's going to be times when you don't feel like you have it. And we've all encountered residents who maybe have not worked to their utmost or have kind of extracted the most from their educational experience or maximized their patient outcomes because maybe they don't want to ever set aside their own well-being.
I would say in terms of the number, in some ways it does surprise me, and in other ways it doesn't. At first I'm like, oh my goodness, 70% are like 70% of residents are burned out or depressed or fatigued. And at first, like, wow, that seems like a lot. But then, you know, I think in looking at it a little bit further, like, you know, I would say in some ways, you know, have 70% of residents at some point felt burnt out or fatigued or depressed, I would say that actually is probably, you know, close to maybe what I imagined. But I think, you know, as we all know, any residency is difficult. There's a lot of very stressful times where a lot of times learning things and doing things, you know, really pushed out of our comfort zone. And I think, you know, even in my own residency with you guys, there were definitely periods of time when I felt burnt out or fatigued or anxious about things. And I think that, I just like you said, Jay, I think there's, people, there's kind of different propensities, susceptibilities to have these issues. And I think the most important thing is to recognize that, you know, that this is a normal thing. And I think to, again, try to remove that stigma. I think this is like over society in general, just over mental health, is that when people, are having these issues and it is, really adversely affecting their performance, that there are programs in place or people that they can go to in terms of, you know, how do we rectify that? Is that taking a little bit of time off? Is that working with them, a more senior resident to help out with things? And so I think that is something that, I think ophthalmology, as well as other residential programs in general, need to strive to do better. And in terms of what does that solution actually look like, it's really hard to say. I think part of it is just because, you know, the residents are always, they have kind of obligations every day and potentially incorporating some kind of margin where that allows people, you know, essentially to be able to take a little bit of time off or work on these other, activities could be better. You know, I think sometimes mandating like wellness programs in general or having like a wellness day, that doesn't really help as much. Cause I remember in medical school, we had these things like, oh, every like 8 weeks, we would have like a wellness day where we'd go and talk about our feelings. And I think that kind of forced, wellness doesn't necessarily work as well. And I'm still trying to figure out, you know, is it just some time where you just give one of the residents some time off every once in a while to take care of themselves? Or perhaps it's other, you know, I think when you think about like large corporations, like Google, a lot of times will have like the dry cleaning or daycare on site or things to make, to help, workers take care of the rest of their lives so they can focus on the work. I think incorporating some of those kinds of things can definitely be helpful because a lot of times it's not just the ophthalmology work itself, it's balancing also their personal life, especially if they have a significant other, if they have children. A lot of times it's personal things that happen. Maybe it's illness of a loved one that then, you know, before they were able to handle everything, but now with this additional obligation, it's just a little bit too much. And I think to be able to help as much as possible in terms of taking care of those, their errands or kind of personal things, I think can be a tangible way in which we can try to improve wellness.
That was really well said. I don't really have anything to add on top of that.
I think you hit a lot of great points, Dan.
I mean, I think the ancillary, quote unquote, having those ancillary real life services is helpful. I think, you know, the one thing we didn't address is the, and I mentioned it a little bit, is the learning curve, right? I think ophthalmology can be stress. Every residency you go to is stressful for different reasons, you know, whether it's internal medicine, which you may have encountered more in medical school, or something like ophthalmology, which is very subspecialized. And maybe, you know, there's very different kind of knowledge bases for people starting their ophthalmology residency. We always said people are not expected to know ophthalmology really when they start. And that's true. I mean, I think in our class when we started, we all had kind of differing knowledge bases. And I think all of us would agree that none of the three of us were the most knowledgeable people in terms of ophthalmology when we started. And that learning curve is overcome because you're working and you're reading and you can overcome that. However, are there things we can do to like decrease that learning curve somehow? And things have been discussed. People have discussed about doing integrated internships so there's more time to kind of learn ophthalmology, to incorporate ophthalmology into people's internship programs so they have some pre-exposure that's in a less stressful setting where they're not trying to balance as much. People have discussed controversial things such as extending the residency, where they do 4 years in Canada and we do 3 years here of ophthalmology. There's multiple solutions proposed, especially as more and more information is necessary to become a good ophthalmologist in terms of keeping current with the literature and the advances. Those are all, I think, solutions that may help as well. But Dan, you brought up all really good points about the real life aspect of some of this, is that just because you're a resident doesn't mean that the rest of your life stops. And there's all these other things going on. Every person has different things going on behind the scenes, even if they all are going through the same clinics or rotations, whatever, every person is not the same.
Yeah, and Jay, actually, I just thought of one other. I think one other thing that's really important is I think also peer mentoring and peer counseling, like say within, I think among the residents, and of course it depends on the culture and nature of your residency. But I think one thing, of course, there's always this feeling that, oh, I gotta pull my weight and perform my best and look good in front of others. But hopefully, like among, I think most residency programs, you know, the residents have a feeling that we need to kind of take care of each other and kind of self-police and such. And I think that was one thing that was really critically important, at least in my residency, is just, I think, having the two of you guys as co-residents where we can, you know, to feel like you're not alone. That's certain things like, oh, you know, I'm trying to still rest, I can't see anything. And then to hear like, oh, Dan, you're really far behind, or no, you know, we're all doing that. And I think talking, so a lot of the things are things that everyone's gone through, but I think to be able to be, you know, vulnerable and authentic to other people, whether it's in your own class or in people in your upper years, and I think realizing that everyone's going through the same thing, and what you're going through, likely someone has gone through that, and perhaps having better mechanisms in place to train, the more like the second and third year residents and formal like kind of peer mentoring and things like that, and so I think develop that, I think, is really critically important, because when I think about at least my residency, and I'm sure other people's residency, it's really the camaraderie among the residents themselves, I think, that a lot of times get people through this and probably likely have the most pertinent you know, feedback.
Right, and what I try to tell the residents as they move on or they leave first year here, which tends to be the most stressful year from work, you know, all the things are balancing standpoint, is also try not to forget. Like we spent some time, all three of us, thinking back and thinking about what it was like to be a resident and what how we felt and what we how we would have responded to the survey. I think it's important not to lose that. It, whether you're a senior resident or you're intending, like just try to think back and just remember. Or if you're having stressful moments, even now as a first-year resident, you're listening to this, just try to hold that, not necessarily as a negative, but just keep that in your mind. Because one day you're not going to be as uncomfortable, and you're going to be comfortable, and your exam's going to be easy. Like, you're going to be able to see things. You're going to be able to do things. But to remember what it's like not to be as comfortable is very helpful when you're thinking about how to appropriately mentor. Because you say, like you said, if you can just normalize certain things and make people feel like they're not necessarily doing things that are you know, way different, and that they're not alone, as you said, Dan, that can go a long way into improving morale.
Yeah, I think the normalization of that feeling of not knowing anything is really key. And I think, especially as a first year, you know, as you keep learning things, everybody else above you keeps learning things too. It's not until that new first year class comes in that you really recognize how much you learned during that year. And so I definitely remember, you know, feeling like, man, I'm just so behind. But it's just normal because everybody else is learning with you. And then the new first years come, you're like, oh, I actually know things. And I always try to remind my first years that's the moment when you're going to learn it. And you actually are learning so much. It's hard to realize it in the moment because there's still so much more to learn.
You know, I remember how it feels from like 5 minutes ago, which is how I feel every time I talk to you, then I'm, man, I have no idea what these guys are talking about. I'm so behind. So I get constant reminders of it. But for some people, I just need to think back a few years. Well, I'm going to, speaking on that vein, I'm going to take the low-hanging fruit and take the easy, fun one to finish, which is effects of milk versus dark chocolate consumption on visual acuity and contrast sensitivity within 2 hours. This is a randomized clinical trial with an amazing title from April 26, 2018 in JAMA Ophthalmology. By Rabin et al. And essentially what they tried to do, they took 30 adults, and it was a crossover clinical trial, and what they did is they gave them either a dark or a milk chocolate bar, and they did this in separate sessions, and then they did this over about 3 months in 2017, and what they looked at was their contrast sensitivity, and within, I think it was, within 2 hours, so within 1.75 hours, so that's 105 minutes of eating these bars. And essentially what they found was that after consumption of a dark chocolate bar versus a milk chocolate bar, your contrast sensitivity and visual acuity was better. This is not super groundbreaking. I'm not going to ask Ajay how this will change his clinical practice, because I don't think it will. However, Dan and Ajay, quick thoughts on dark chocolate versus milk chocolate.
I've always been in the dark chocolate camp, but I'm so happy there's finally some evidence to support me. So this paper is great.
Dan?
You know, it's interesting, actually. I thought they did a really good...
It was a really well-done study.
Because the first thing they... This is kind of trivial, but... The interesting thing was that, you know, they did the crossover where they did the reverse group. So, you know, you could think, there's different levels of flavonoids that they were really thinking was the main active ingredient. But, you know, there's also different levels of caffeine and other things like that. But they had either the group start with dark chocolate and then 3 days later do the milk chocolate. So they were all normalized to themselves, which I think is really critical, because I think if you didn't do that, then there would be a lot more limitations to the study. And so it is interesting that you can see a statistically significant effect. I mean, I think it would be cool if they had also done, they talked about retinal blood flow being a big thing.
OCTA.
Pre
and post, yeah.
But it's still pretty interesting. I think in terms of what that means long term, it's hard to say, but I think they were looking at this, I think it was a really nice way to test this hypothesis, and I have to say I really like the study design.
Yeah, and it led to all sorts of great new headlines, like from WebMD, a bit of dark chocolate might sweeten your vision, or from Forbes, forget carrots, eat dark chocolate instead.
From this standpoint, it got a lot of news coverage, and it's just interesting, like kind of the things that I was just learning, like the things that like news people think make news are generally very different than what we may think news, and a lot of it's catering to the lay people, and so I think this had a lot of those elements as well.
I mean, I'm sort of a news person. I guess I'm a hybrid chimera news person retina specialist, so that's why we're talking about this in addition to the other one. And this will be officially known as an inside joke as the Yasha Modi study. If you're listening, this is your study. So I will let you guys go. Final thoughts, both of you. NBA season is over. It is off season. Both your teams had sad seasons compared to expectations. Dan, what is your number one goal for the Wizards this off season? Any goals? Any expectations?
I think player development. I think they have a good core with
I'm going to interrupt you. That means you don't have cap space to sign anybody when people say player development.
Oh, that's kind of, yeah. I think you got to develop from within. I mean, you got to look like people like Victor Oladipo, or I'm sorry, I massacred his last name, but he was kind of thrown in as a toss-in, but then really became a superstar. So I think part of it is, I think developing those within your organization to improve rather than trying to go out and go out and get the flashy free agent, because those people are costly, and most people now don't want to go for the luxury tax. So I think you have to develop within.
Would you trade Otto Porter for DeMarcus Cousins? That's been rumored.
Ooh, that's do they have similar? They're both on max contracts, right?
Well, Cousins is a free agent, but I would assume he's going to be signed to a max deal. But he tore his Achilles, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But his max will be a lot more than Porter's max.
Yes, so they'll probably have to be throw-ins.
But if they had equal salary, yes, I would.
Ajay, goals for the Knicks this offseason?
Oh, there's so many goals. I think hopefully we'll be able to steal somebody in the draft who can actually be a good contributor. I think working on developing some of our young talent that we have is going to be key. And hopefully Chris Dotts mends well and comes back and is able to do what he was doing before he got injured.
Well, again, my team is capped out too, so that is the sign of a capped out team when you say we're going to draft well and hopefully our coach can change the culture. Well, guys, thank you for doing this. It was a longer episode, but thanks for, it was very important, I think, and hopefully all the ophthalmologists, residents, fellows listening will appreciate it, and regardless of the stage they're at. And I'll happily have you guys on soon, and if not, I'll see you hopefully at ASRS, so take care.
Great. All right. Thanks, Jay. Thanks for having us.
Bye-bye. As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. All 116 episodes, including this one, can be found there, sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Ground and Reactive, lessons from our pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We are on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Chow and Kurian for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benitas, and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Finally, listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.